We all want to build a better business so we can be better architects. Well, a better business starts with planning for profit. Download your free course, Profit for Small Firm Architects, at entrearchitect.com/free course. You're listening to Entree Architect Podcast, and this is episode 189. Welcome back to the Entree Architect Podcast. My name is Mark R. LePage, and this is the podcast dedicated to a successful life as a small firm architect. Whether you have plans to someday start your own firm, whether you're in the process of launching a startup, or you might be an experienced small firm architect just trying to make a difference, this podcast is for you. My goal is to inspire you to build a better business so that you may pursue your purpose with passion and live the life of your dreams. This episode of Entree Architect Podcast is supported by our platform sponsors, FreshBooks, Core by BQE Software, and Arcat. And I'm going to share more about these great companies later in the show, but before we get started here, just take a quick note to schedule some time later today, as soon as you're finished listening here, to go visit each one of them and let them know that you appreciate them for supporting us, the Entree Architect community. Tabitha Ponte, welcome to Entree Architect Podcast.
Thank you so very much. I am excited to be here, and thank you for all your help this week too with our babies campaign. That was fantastic.
Yeah, you're very, very welcome. It's my pleasure to help, and we can get into that a little bit too. I'd love to talk about what that was and why you did that. Let me tell the audience a little bit about you, who you are. Tabitha Ponte is a licensed architect and builder, a philanthropist, a mother, and a wife who's leading Ponte Health and affiliate companies, a firm based in Orlando, Florida, specializing in single source delivery, resources management, and best outcomes, serving exclusively the healthcare market sector. And Tabitha's story is fascinating to me. I've been following her. She's been a friend of mine online for a long time. We've communicated over the years, and I've watched her sort of grow and then sort of slowly disappear, and I didn't see you for a little while. And then you came back with a vengeance, and you're all over the place now, and you are growing like a wildfire. It is so exciting to watch you. So I want to get into that story. I want to share that story with our listeners so they can follow your journey too. Let's start with your origin story. Let's start with going way, way back to where you discovered architecture, what inspired you to become an architect, and then give us that story to up to where you are today, and then we'll go from there.
Okay. I will try to make it as short as possible. My origin, I was a child, actually, when I discovered architecture. I must have been 7 or 8. And I remember talking to my mother in a car, specifically in Caracas, Venezuela, which is where I spent my childhood, telling her about how I felt about spatial structures. I basically told her something along the lines of, "Mom, it's funny. I don't see the stuff. I see the void. I see the emptiness." in so many words, I said something like that. So she said, "Tabitha, let me tell you what an architect and an engineer, what they do." So she explained to me the difference between architecture and engineering in that car ride. And right away, I told her, "I am going to be an architect." I had to be probably 7 or 8.
Yeah.
It has sort of progressed. I did have family members in architecture. Most of them were men that I watched make models and do drawings. And one of them, and this was probably significantly influential for me, one of them designed and built his own house. And I spent significant time in that house. It was sort of like a mid-century modernist, simple, lots of concrete and steel. And you know, and I vividly remember sort of the influence that the house had on me, and knowing that he created it, it just sort of added to that. Like, I'm going to be an architect.
How old was that when you that house?
The house, it was still around the same time. 7, okay. 8, 9, 10, yeah. Around that age.
Yep.
So I worked, despite being very involved in music at the time. I always worked with the notion that I would go to architecture school, and my also despite my life being difficult, along the way, I still sort of saw that. I didn't make it to architecture school until I was about 24.
Okay.
But I was one of the more, I don't want to call them mature students, but yes, I was sort of in the higher end of the age range to start architecture school. So that's a,
so
that's
what delayed you from starting architecture school?
Working. I always had to work. I believe I was 17. I don't think I was even 18 when I left my household to be self-sufficient. So I was, you know, a waitress and went around lots of different restaurants, worked really long hours, many days. Though I started college early because I was one of those dual enrollment kids, there was a point where I had sort of a depressive state of chaos that broke all that off. And I had a break of 3 or 4 years before I was able to get back on it. I had moved cities, and when I got back on, I was in the Fort Lauderdale area, which is where I went to school.
So how did school bring you to the U.S. from Venezuela?
Yes, but I was born here. I'm actually, born in Fort Pierce, which is this tiny, tiny town in the east coast of Florida. And I went back to Fort Pierce. That's where I went to high school, and where I started college.
Okay, so you were born here, went to Venezuela, came back around high school age.
Yes.
Went through high school, then stayed in Florida for college. And then did you graduate from Fort Lauderdale?
Yes, I graduated. I think it took me about 8 years to graduate architecture school. And it was in Fort Lauderdale. And then I worked all along. I was one of those kids that, or by this time adult, I guess, that I worked all through college. So all of my architecture school was simultaneous to IDP. So, you know, that new track that IDP has for people to get licensed faster.
Yep.
I managed to do that before that existed. And I know I actually have a letter from the state of Florida that I'd finished my IDP hours before I got my diploma from college.
So you were working in architecture?
Yes.
During school?
Yes.
Got it.
Yeah. And I used to tell people to do it and people thought I was a crazy person, but I was eligible for my exam literally the year I graduated.
Were you working all in the same firm or were you moving around to different firms?
I did three different firms through college. I started in Fort Pierce with a firm called Peacock and Lewis out of West Palm Beach. They have I don't know if it's still there, but it must be in Fort Pierce, a small office. I was there. And then I moved to like a mid-sized commercial firm in Fort Lauderdale. But I'd already, I'm trying to go back to the timeline. My brain's a little scattered, but I worked in construction somewhere in that point, right? In a high rise, it's a place called Azolas River House. I was on the job site as a assistant project manager, basically.
While you were in school, you were doing that.
While I was in school. And you know, so they hated architects and I said, maybe I can be a better one if I understand both sides.
Yeah. I did same thing. I didn't work on commercial. I did it with residential, but I did the same thing for the same reason, because I wanted to know why contractors didn't like architects.
Exactly.
I came from a family that had builders and carpenters, and I constantly heard how the architects were no good and I wanted to know why. And so I did that same thing.
Yeah. So by the time I got through that, which was about a year on a job site, like in the trailer for a structural subcontractor. So we did the steel and concrete. I did lots of takeoffs and man hours and things like that, RFIs and things of that nature. I got picked up by PGAL, which is a significantly large firm out of Texas, but they have a Boca Raton office. And I did all of my IDP hour at PGAL in Boca Raton. When I graduated, I was given the opportunity to sort of step up into a leading role as an architectural project manager, if you will. But then the market crashed, which was, you know, I tried to put it all together, but at the end of the day, it was 2008, like everything sort of fell apart, especially in Florida.
Yeah.
And all of that eventually led me to Chicago, which
so,
is, you know,
so before the we next get into Chicago, so in Florida, you're going to architecture school. You're taking you're working in architecture firms. You're working out in the construction, in real construction. You're not just sitting there watching and visiting sites. You're actually in there doing construction, learning the business of construction and the administrative parts of it.
Yep.
Doing all of that work from both sides. And then you graduate from with all that experience. And so did you stay in Florida at first, or did as soon as you graduated you were out?
No, I stayed a little longer, but through that market crash. So it wasn't helpful, you know, like I was in a, like I said, in a sort of a leading architectural PM position when I got out, not with PGA or with another firm. At this point, I led and did the design of something called Miami Green Lab, which was a LEED Gold for the city of Miami, which they use as their sustainability office. And right after that, I sort of couldn't find my way back into architecture with, again, the market crash. That became convoluted in the state. Not a lot of people could work, period, in architecture. Yeah. I even think that office that I was with at the time for Green Lab disappeared. The whole office disappeared. Yeah. And that happened with a lot of firms here. I actually remember, without naming any names, I remember a firm with 200 or 300 people that disappeared overnight in the same, around the same time. So it's just all the work here halted.
And so so you said, okay, I'm out?
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. And so what pulled you to Chicago?
About school again. Yeah. Well, Chicago, I had visited. And somehow I thought I'd probably live in the city. And it was between Chicago and Germany. I had both opportunities. I was given admission into the German school that Mies van der Rohe started in Bauhaus. So I was going to go there.
Yeah.
But then I was given the opportunity to just stay in the States and go to Chicago. And Mies was there.
Right.
And I'm a big Mies fan. If you know anything about me, I even have a tattoo that says so.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, I have you'll see it right here, a less is more on my wrist.
I see that. Mies
van der Rohe. I'm a big modernist, if you will. But
that's dedication to tattoo it to your wrist.
Well, it's also a small reminder of what it really means that less is more.
Yeah.
It's not just about Mies for me. It had more meanings than that. But so I ended up in Chicago rather than Germany, but in the same sort of space, this place where mid-century modern and design build are appreciated. Mies started Crown Hall and the architecture school at Illinois Tech, which is where I did my graduate degree. Now, because of the market crash and because of my experience through that point, I didn't do architecture as my graduate degree. I didn't feel like that was the right thing to do, at least for me. I really felt like I needed to complement architecture, and I'd already gotten past my IDP and I was testing. So what I did when I went to IIT is actually I started in structural because I've always been fascinated by it. But after about a year, I thought, well, if I stay in structural, even though I'll finish, I'm still in the design phase. And I made the deliberate decision to move over to the construction phase. So construction is what became my graduate degree from Illinois Tech. And it's in there. It's actually both an engineering and a management degree. So it's a management, but engineering based.
So you have all this architecture experience undergrad, mm-hmm. and it's your passion is the architecture. Mm-hmm. You go to Chicago in order to sort of expand your knowledge and have this experience with Mies and his world up there. Start in structural and end up in construction because you realize mm-hmm. that's where you really want to be.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens?
Well, Chicago got dense and busy and cold for me.
Yeah, it is cold.
It's really cold. I mean, the year I left, which was not that long ago, got to a negative 55. And as a Floridian, that negative 55 was just really something really difficult to handle for me. I really couldn't. I couldn't bear it anymore, the idea of being in the winter. And I always thought, oh, maybe if I could be a snowbird and share my space between Chicago and Florida, it would be fantastic. So that's where I stand today, trying to be that person that is in both places. So that time passed, and you remember I took this road trip around the country. Yeah. And did a lot of mountain climbing for introspection in Oregon particularly. And I didn't think I would come back to Florida. I really didn't. But life would have it that it would pull me toward my family. And then I don't know if it was like motherly nature. It sunk in and I started to cry and I have to stay here and my niece and nephews.
Your roots.
Yes. The children, you know, my sister's kids, I'd missed almost their whole lives through school and working. And that sort of kept me in Florida and in the Orlando area specifically, because I even thought maybe I'll go back to Miami, Fort Lauderdale, which is what I know. And nope, I stayed in Orlando.
Yeah. So when you were up in Chicago, you were in Chicago when we first met, when we first connected, you were in Chicago.
Yes. Yes.
And actually we did, actually you're the only one, we did a podcast recording early on in the Entree Architect podcast. About a school you were developing. And so you started developing a school, and then you decided, okay, right as I was going to publish the podcast, you said, I'm considering a change, and you changed direction at that point. Can you just talk about that school a little bit, about what that was and why make that change?
Yes, I will also try to keep it brief. The reason for the school was because I really feel like I want people to know how I've developed. I've been able to, as some of us do, but not everybody, develop this more holistic self in this field that it's capable of not just of design, but of resources management and leading a job site. And so the idea of the school was that. But it was such pressure against my developing the school.
Yep.
Generally, it was just so hard. And you remember this, I invested years.
Yeah. That's why I don't want to skip over it. Cause I think it's a very important part of your story. And I think it's a significant ingredient in where you are today.
Yes. So it was really about teaching what I know and how I've been able to, and really, two things happened that led me to stop and to do what I do now. One thing is I got sick, and not once, but twice. And both times I was in a sort of a deathbed situation. The first was in Chicago, as you recall. I had an incident that was with my digestive system, and it basically shut down. And they couldn't find an answer, and I spent 2 weeks through radiation and all kinds of stuff. And it was stress built up over time for my work and education and all of that. I had to make some serious life changes. That's what led me to yoga and the way I eat and then climbing mountains and all these things. And then the second event was more recent here, which was my small stroke that I suffered a little over a year ago now, or about a year ago now. That was sort of the ultimate straw. Of stopping the push against a system.
Yep.
And just reverting back to developing a self. And perhaps people will still get what I want them to get, but by example, rather than the developing of the institution.
That's why I didn't want to miss the institution.
Yes.
Because you're doing the same thing. You're just doing it a different way.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And this way is working.
Yes, it seems to be working well.
Yeah, and so let's just go back real quick. So you're in Chicago, and you've graduated, and you have all of this information. You have construction experience and architecture experience, and now you want to teach other architects how to do what you think is the right way to do architecture, or a successful way of doing architecture.
Yes.
This integrated process where you design it and build it and deliver it all in one package, and you're going to teach other architects how to do that, and that's this school that you were trying to put together. You got pretty far along with that, mm-hmm. but it was a constant push, constant struggle to get to where you wanted it to be, and then you got sick. And so there's this push and pull, and it's not working, and then you get sick, and it's sickness is stress related. I can, I
a
have,
lot of it, yes.
yeah, I have experience with that as well, having significant illness through stress. I didn't want to brush over that either because I think there are a lot of architects out there who may be experiencing stress-related illnesses and not realize that it's stress.
Yep.
So if you're out there and you are feeling strange or things aren't working or you're not healthy and your doctors can't figure out what it is, consider that it might be stress. It sounds a little strange until you're in that situation and you realize that it is.
Yes.
And so that is a significant turning point in your life. Okay, I'm sick. This is not working. I need to make a different direction. So you say, okay, I'm not doing this anymore and I'm going to go take a break and I'm going to go find myself and I'm going to go out and hike. And so let's just go from that point. You're out, so you decide, okay, I'm not going to do this school and I need a break and I need to find a way to get the stress released so I don't end up dead. So where do you go and what do you do before you end up coming back to make the decision to go back to Florida?
I basically traveled through about 15 states by car with my dog. I dropped everything I had in Chicago. I just sort of dropped it off. And there were the people, colleagues, that thought I was irresponsible, but they didn't understand that that I almost died, basically. And this was the outcome of that. So I traveled through 15 states, staying, watching sunrises and everyone I could. And when I was climbing, I was alone. I would turn off the phone. I climbed alone at least three mountains, of which one was a summit. I couldn't do all three summits. It was winter. There is snow. There's some that you just can't reach unless you have an ice pick. So I thought that I would stay in that space because that space was, like the other end of the spectrum. I got sick and stressed and almost died, and now I'm in this bliss that you find when you climb a mountain. So I almost thought I would stay there. I really did intend to stay. I was in Bend, Oregon, which is like 4 hours deep into east from Portland, like deep into the forest, basically. It's a place that's almost like secret. Nobody knows about it, but it's fantastic. It's phenomenal. I stayed there for 4 or 5 weeks, just my dog on a farm and me climbing mountains as much as I could, until the turning point for me from that point was snow again. Like the thought of a snowstorm just came like running against me, and I said, "Oh no!" I got, and I called my dad. "No, I think I'm going back to Florida." And I felt there was also some level of loneliness because that almost dying event, I was alone in Chicago. So that also dragged along. So I came back here, and the first thing I did was go to my sister's house. And she's been in the Orlando area for over a decade. So I just landed there. There's my niece and nephew who are at this point like 10 and 7. And I was just so elated, like so happy to be home, basically, or what felt like home. So that's how I never left again. I attempted it. I attempted to leave. There was a point where I thought I was going to get on a plane and go back to Chicago. I tried to work my way back. It just didn't go that way. And I happened to stay here long enough that I met my husband, and so on, et cetera, who was in my sister's life for many years, but I was not in my sister's life for many years. So,
That's a fascinating story. I love
yeah.
those connections. So you're out in Bend, Oregon, and you love it, and it's just a wonderful place to be. And then you realize that there's going to be snow. Snow's
Yes.
coming, and you just don't want to. You already left Chicago because of the snow and the cold, and you just don't want to deal with it. So you're like, okay, I'm out of here,
Yes.
and you go back home. Basically, you go back to Florida.
It sounds like a freaking soap opera. Like when I listen to my own life, it's just like I can't believe how
But
complicated
that's what's
it
so fascinating about your
is.
story. That's why I wanted you on the show because I've followed you all the way through. And when you were out there on the mountains, you disappeared from online. So I didn't know where you went. The last I heard was that the school wasn't going to happen. Scrap the podcast recorded, which is still in the archive somewhere. It's the only one that's never been released. And so you're out there and you disappeared. And then all of a sudden you came back and you came back with a vengeance. So you obviously, you're out there, you come back home to the warmth, you come back home to your family, mm-hmm. and obviously it's where you belong. It's where you should be at that moment. All of mm-hmm. these things that have happened to you through the story, obviously to me, as I'm listening to this, they all had to happen in order to get to where you are today. That if you pull yes. out any one of those pieces, as hard as some of them may have been, you would have not been where you are today if you didn't experience that big loop that you went through.
Correct.
And so now you're back in, you end up back in Florida. You realize, uh-huh. okay, this is warm for one. I'm home. And you're actually home. You're not literally home. It wasn't Orlando wasn't your home, but you're with your sister and you're yes. with your nephews and your nieces, and it's your home. And so mm-hmm. when you went back to Florida, did you know what you were going to do? Or did you just kind of go back and say, okay, I'm just going back there and we'll see where it leads?
Yes, it was more like that. And because of my very significant and broad experience, I became sort of this interest for government. So I dive into government, first county, then city, with a break in between for my pregnancy. The government agencies love me because I am licensed, but I can cross over and I can do both parts well, the architecture part and the construction part. So in Chicago, before leaving, not that I want to revert back, I was an owner rep for the city, for the state. Mm-hmm. And when I got here, it was a direct hire basically from the government.
So you're working for the government, a government
yes,
employee.
When I first arrived yep. in Orlando, yes.
Okay. And and that type of, what were you doing with that type of work? You just sort of administrative work?
It was a crossover yet again between public works construction and then eventually asset management, which is more like an architectural role. But during my pregnancy, I made the very deliberate decision to stay home and do zero work. So yeah. I was pregnant at home all of the pregnancy, which is 10 months plus 4 months mm-hmm. of my daughter. So for about 14 months, I didn't really work. And all I did was read, exercise, do yoga and eat well, go to the gym. And when I say read, this brings me back to the meaning, being prepared for what I do now. Lots of that reading was strategy, marketing, business, architecture, construction, like reading technical things for my license, reading things for entrepreneurship and business. And then I like to think that she brought that to me, but I feel like my daughter created the firm that we run today. It feels to me that she did that on her way here, basically, because it was so clear. It was just so vivid. Somewhere about halfway in my pregnancy, what I was supposed to do with Ponte Health.
So that idea happened while you were pregnant.
Yes.
You stopped. You took a break. You weren't yes. doing any work, so that your mind was clear.
Yes.
Which those lessons you learned when you hit the mountains. So you learned, okay, this is an important event in my life. I need to stop, and I'm going to experience this event, and I'm going yes. to be pregnant, and I'm going to have my child, and I'm going to experience being a mom before I take the next step, wherever that may lead. And while you're pregnant, this idea comes to you.
Yes. Yes. What would become Ponte Health? It was originally a much longer name, but it was like, it was Ponte Healthcare Architecture and Planning. And then it eventually technically just sort of compressed into Ponte Health because it started to just develop into so many. Like it wanted to become so many things that mm-hmm. I said, okay, I can't call it Ponte Healthcare Architecture and Planning because it was limiting.
It was bigger than that.
Yes.
The mission yes. and the vision were bigger than architecture and planning.
Yes. Yes.
So when did you know that it was bigger? Immediately that this idea was bigger, or did it start as architecture and planning and then you just say, well, I can do this and I can do that and I can do this? How did that transition happen?
I don't know. I wish I could pinpoint how that happened.
So it's just, it was an evolution.
Yes. I only remember thinking, like, if I were to put myself or remain Ponte Healthcare Architecture and Planning, that I wasn't going to be able to tap on all that time that I spent in a job site.
Yeah.
Like that I was going to be limited to construction administration rather than be put on the in the field.
Right.
And in not it's not only my experience, but even my education, right, was half construction. So why would I do that? And it just sort of evolved. And then I thought, well, I also want to give back. I also want to, so it made sense for it to become Ponte Health, that right. It's not about the thing that I do, but about the mission, which reads to help expand the healing community, whatever that means.
Yeah.
Whatever it takes for me to accomplish that, basically. And as we started, it just slowly became, okay, my husband, who's my business partner, is a realtor. He works with a broker. That made sense, that relationship, where we can pull people in through the brokerage firm. And so now it's no longer even just design or design and construction. Now we can take people in from before owning the property. And it just, that's how it happened. It just kept, it could be this other thing. It could be technology. It could be the giving back. It could be, and it just, it's become more than I, than where we started, basically. And it's moving. Like, it moves.
It evolves and grows.
Effortlessly. It doesn't take the work that I was putting into some of my other.
right. So now you've created this new organization, and it is doing the same thing that your school was going to teach, but now you're doing it for you.
Yes.
And you're creating this organization. And so you come up with the idea while you're pregnant, you have your daughter, you spend the time with her. What was the actual next step to go to where you want to go? So you have this idea. Now you're going to execute on that idea. What did you do?
I had to leap. There's a leaping point, whether we like it or not, where it's really scary, because you say, well, if I leap, like, from a job, how am I going to actually make it happen? You know, and I had people that surrounded me that would say, you know how to do it. You know what to do. You've been doing this for 16, 17 years. You've, you know, represented the government. You did that at many levels, city level, state level. You've been inside government. Plus, you've done design and construction on a job site. You know exactly what you need to do. But you're still scared to death.
Yeah.
Like, and I have, you know, and in my case, with a child, a young child, one that wasn't even one, how am I going to do that thing, really? So I take the leap, and it's ridiculously scary. And you're like, okay, if you have to leap, and what is the next thing you do? So the first thing was to acquire some accessible office space with an address that was, you know, credible. And so I moved into Lake Nona, which is known as Medical City. Of course, it was like a hitting the nail on the head with a hammer, moving into Medical City. But it was accessible, right? It's a co-work space. It doesn't cost a lot. And then pushing little bits at a time. Like, what is the first thing? Okay, I need a business card. Okay, then what's the second best thing? Well, I need to get meetings with every hospital system. Those, by the way, were very difficult. But if you're insistent enough, and if you can find the right person, even if it means asking many people, and you can figure out a way to sit down, and you're honest, they will listen. And a lot of times, you know, doesn't mean they're going to give you work. I've experienced both ways. But sometimes you will find somebody that, if you listen to enough, you realize that they do need you, and that you can actually give them what they need, and then they trust it, and they take the same leap back to you, because it is a leap when they don't know you, which is what was happening to me. They don't know who I am. Like, I'm this sort of 30-something, which is young to begin with, to be running some firm, and I just show up and I tell them, sure, I can run your construction. It doesn't matter that you have $5 billion of capital improvements. So there's a certain level of leap from their end.
Yep.
And you have to sort of do, you know, whatever it takes to blow out of the water whatever expectations they may have of you, which is how that's sort of how I've been operating, where, you know, they think one thing, and that can prove that not only can I do what I promise, but I've overdone. basically is how I run my everyday for the firm.
So you're persistent.
Persistence is a big thing. It's I think one of the main
Because
things.
you're building this from scratch, and that's a question that I get all the time. How do I start a firm? Well, the first thing you do is you come up with this idea and you create this vision and this mission, and this is what you're going to do. And then you decide to leap, which is the hardest part. I've actually written a blog post on that. And actually, my very first podcast episode, my introduction episode of the podcast is about taking a leap. And it's about the podcast, but it's the same idea, is that if you don't jump, you'll never get to where you want to go. You have to take that leap. So you have to make that decision, and then you're just incrementally saying, okay, what do I do next? 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 And you just kept doing that over and over and over again. And finally, you got to the point of, now I have to get some clients. And you're doing this with no portfolio, no, you have lots of experience, but you have no company yet. I mean, the company's there and it's established, but now you're going to go try to convince these people who are have the jobs that you want to perform to give you the work. And so you said, okay, I'm just not going to take no for an answer. I'm just going to keep saying, just keep m meeting and keep meeting and keep meeting to the same people or new people and just keep going. And every time you do that, you get a little bit better at that. You learn a little bit more about who they are and what they're looking for and how you can deliver to them. And so every time you do it over and over and over again, you get a lot of no's up front. But the more you do it, you start getting a couple of yeses here and there with little things, and you learn, oh, well, what made them say yes there? Oh, I'll keep doing that, right? So you keep learning and learning and learning until you start getting work. And then once you have work, then you can use that work to get more work, right?
And then also have the work transform, because that's the position that we're in. When you're first sort of looking to get enough to at least get by as a firm, at that point you need to do, I don't want to say whatever it takes to get by, because that's the wrong, and I'll talk about that, I guess. That's the wrong thing to do. You can't just take anything. I think that's detrimental to a firm, actually. It's more focused than that. It's yes, maybe at some level get anything, but are you serving the right person? Are you in the right market? Are you really, or is it you're getting anything just to get by? Because if you're getting anything to just get by with no order, with no strategy, then you're not going to get very far, and it will always be anything to just get by. That deliberate decision, in my, at least in our case, where it was about healthcare, that was very deliberate for both my situations where I was sick, and also the market in general. It wasn't an accidental decision. I thought through market growth, opportunity. Who does it? Does anybody really even do it the way I want to do it? And the answer was always, yes, I have room. No one's doing what you're trying to do. Yes, there is a need. Yes, it grows and never stops growing, actually. So all those answers, they play a part.
And that's market analysis. So if people are listening and you've heard market analysis and you wonder what it is, that's what it is. You chose healthcare, and you chose a target market. That's something that I talk about a lot, is choose a target market. Can't just do whatever you want to do. You want to choose a market. So you've chosen healthcare, and there was a reason you chose healthcare, because of your experience and the things that you've gone through and your new lifestyle. And the market there was screaming for what you provide as a in healthcare in Florida. And so Florida is healthcare, central.
Yes,
And so it's,
especially Orlando,
yeah, and
like where we
so
are.
it's the right thing, it's the right market to choose. Let's take a quick break here to say thank you to our platform sponsors here at Entree Architect: BQE Software, Arcat, and FreshBooks. This podcast episode is sponsored by BQE Software, the makers of BQE Core. BQE Core revolutionizes the way architects manage projects, time and expenses, billing, and accounting. Made by BQE, the company behind ArchiOffice, Core saves you time while giving you the visibility, the flexibility, and the power you need to grow your firm. Work from anywhere, seamlessly collaborate, and gain transformative insights with Core's groundbreaking platform. Learn more and get a free trial at entrearchitect.com/BQE. Hey, and if you want to see a demonstration of Core, I recently invited Stephen Burns of BQE Software to join me for a live Entree Architect special session webinar, where Steve had the opportunity to show us inside Core and all it has to offer us small firm architects. And a recording of that webinar is available to our community, the Entree Architect community, for free at entrearchitect.com/BQE webinar. So go check that out. And when you're ready to give it a try, visit entrearchitect.com/BQE and access your fully functional trial of Core free for 15 days. Hey, if you've been listening to this podcast anytime during the past few months, you've heard me talking about our friends over at RCAT. And hopefully you're already using their free resources on a regular basis. But for those of you who have not yet checked them out, RCAT is a great tool for small firm architects. RCAT has a huge library of free content, CAD, BIM, specifications, and more. And they've done all the work for you. I mean it. They've done all the work. If you need a spec, click on over and download a CSI three-part specification in multiple formats, free. How about CAD details or BIM objects, all free, click of a mouse. RCAT has tons of building product content ready for you to use, and it's all completely free. You don't even have to register to download the content. And they've recently launched something new. It's called Charette. Create a project, assign tasks, share and collaborate with colleagues and clients, all in real time. Pull content directly from the RCAT database or from anywhere out on the web and keep it in Charette. It's another free resource from RCAT for you, the Entree Architect community. Visit them right now. Go check them out. EntreeArchitect.com/RCAT. That's A-R-C-A-T. EntreeArchitect.com/RCAT. And click on the Charette icon right there on the homepage to check out Charette. Imagine what you can do if you had an additional 2 days every month to dedicate to anything that you want. Maybe you just want to spend more time on design. Maybe you want to start building that new business process. Maybe you want to start painting again. Maybe you want to spend more time with your kids. Or maybe you want to finally start that development project. Well, when you're a small firm architect using FreshBooks cloud accounting software, you could save 192 hours every month. That's 2 business days every month. That's the amount of administrative time that you could save this year if you're using FreshBooks. FreshBooks makes it simple to send invoices, post your expenses, automatically track your time for the whole team by project, and get organized with reports, communication, and notifications. My favorite feature of FreshBooks is the automated email reminders sent to my clients to remind them to pay their bills. That's done automatically, and you control the whole thing. Sign up for a free 30-day unrestricted trial and get ready for the simplest way to be more productive, organized, and most importantly, get paid faster. Visit EntreeArchitect.com/FreshBooks to access FreshBooks for free. And be sure to enter Entree Architect in the How Did You Hear About Us section. BQE Software, RCAT, and FreshBooks. Please visit our platform sponsors today and thank them for supporting you, the Entree Architect community. And then so now you're being persistent with all of these contacts, meeting them, getting a couple of jobs. What happens now?
Well, now I am in this a little bit of a growth mode. Like I'm in the place where perhaps a couple people can start helping me. And just recently we signed our first actual private smaller physician building, which is, I think, sort of a sweet spot for us where it's either a small physicians group or a doctor, because what we do, which is the efficient resources management, I think where it works best is at that scale. Doesn't mean I don't do it and I cannot do it for the hospital system, because obviously it is working because of my client currently is the largest hospital system in Central Florida. But that small physicians group or single physician really can benefit from how we do things, which goes all the way back to the real estate acquisition. And that includes this particular client that we're working with. She hasn't selected the real estate and we've started. So I become a part of the real estate selection, which comes with jurisdictional analysis and all that stuff. But I mean, sort of simultaneous with the conceptual design process and even financing, if that's what they're going to do. We've sort of partnered with banks and things because they have special programs for medicine, obviously, because the doctors are, when they're licensed, they can make so much money that certain banks have special lending for people that practice medicine. So we've tapped into those banks and we can be that single point for that doctor who, like for this one in case, in all honesty, she's still working as an emergency physician somewhere. She doesn't have time to stop and do all these things herself. So we're doing everything for her from selecting the real estate all the way through, even to her occupancies and all her any not just permits for construction and occupancy for the building, but all her licensing to run the facility as an independent. She's almost like a micro hospital, but that's a client next to our special client, which has been Orlando Health.
So you get to this point, you have these clients now. How many people are working with you now?
We are three at the moment. And to me, really is project dependent, mm-hmm. because I feel like I could be more people. I could really be a lot more people, but we're not there yet. I'm still sort of in the revolving cycle of what it means to be net 30. Net 30 is rough.
What does that mean for people who are listening?
Yes, net 30 means that when you work for somebody like the hospital system, most sort of sophisticated organizations will have this. They will pay out your invoice at net 30, literally like on the 30th day. So you'll invoice them. It doesn't matter how small or big it is. They will sit on that invoice until day 30. That's tough. That's a difficult cycle to break for trying to build working capital in the firm. So I find it that because I'm still within the cycle, it's really hard to hire. Like, it's really hard to bring people in to help me because people work for a paycheck weekly or biweekly. It's very hard for people to work net 30 like the business will.
Right.
I did it actually once as an employee at net 30, and it was very difficult, as it is difficult now for our firm, basically.
So how did you start this firm from scratch? How do you fund the firm? How do you get that first office and the business cards and the employees and all of that stuff?
You bootstrap that. It has to be done that way. I had to bootstrap it from my job, what I had as a job, and really hope for the best. I do have investors.
Talk about that a little bit. Who are they and what do they do?
Okay, so depending on how you create the business structures, in our case, we have a holdings company. It's not above the architect, it's above the building company. And your friends and family have, at least in Florida, by law, have some leeway to buy into your company. You have limitations of how much money they can give you. And it can only be like 99 cents, really around that, a share. That's in what I mean by that is that's outside of the SEC. Like the second you start sort of going outside those boundaries, which I think are set by state, then the SEC gets involved. Mm-hmm. You register shares. You probably have a lawyer doing all this for you, and you sell then your shares at value. And that's how you eventually get to an IPO and all of that in the market. So we have our shareholders, which worked as family and friends. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that was our money to get started outside of my, you know, our own money or my own money too. Right.
So you had some seed funding from investors.
Yes.
That were all family through the family and friends format of investing.
Yes. Which for us now is about 55.
55 people?
Yes, 55 mm-hmm. people. You call that micro investment though. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of money.
Yeah.
Some of them 500, 1,000. You know, small, just enough to sort of get rolling. And if you can find seed money or get a loan or have enough saved up, then it's long enough to get to the point where a client will fund at least minimally your work, or enough that you don't need to struggle. But that process for us was a year. Mm-hmm. It was a year to get to that. And that's a long time.
And so that investment money, that seed money, sort of helped you establish yourself, put together some marketing, do all of that persistent meetings that gives you the money and the finance to build that initial foundation, mm-hmm. until you can get those first clients that then start funding the company. Is that what you did?
Mm-hmm. Yes. And I mean, in the steps that I took with that were very deliberate. You know, I joined every chamber of commerce. I started hosting things for the chamber of commerce. I paid for advertising. I mean, there are things that we think when we get started that we shouldn't be spending money on, but it's not true. To save $200, say for yourself, versus spend the $200 on an ad in some highly read publication, will make a significant difference. For example, very early on, I started a marketing campaign through what is called the Orlando Medical News. Their readership is huge, and most of it is medical. So we, though not millions, we did make the effort to invest on campaigns through them. And that's made a huge difference, because he's more like a partner. He's really helped us push the firm out into the world, if you will, to people that are in medicine, that are not architects, that are not builders, but that are potential clients. Yeah. That's another thing which I would have talked about with regards to starting a firm. Architects are very good, myself included in the past, at talking to each other. We are not very good at talking to our clients. Mm. We don't get out looking for our clients. If you're starting a firm, you really need to stop. Look at your Twitter bait. For example, Twitter. Let's talk about Twitter specifically. When you told me I disappeared, I had a huge Twitter account, thousands of people, maybe 5,000, 6,000 people, yeah. Of which probably 5,000 were architects. I was making the mistake everybody makes. And when I disappeared off the face of the earth, called internet, I took all that out. And in my process of that thinking and being pregnant and being home, I realized I was talking to the wrong people. Like if I want my client to be the hospitals, I need to talk to the hospitals. I don't need to talk to other architects. And I certainly don't need to talk to architects designing hospitals, because that's flat out my competition. So I started very purposefully reestablishing all of my social media around following my clients and connecting with my clients, and not peers or competition. So for example, not just Twitter, because that I follow like a lot of women surgeons in Twitter, but if you look at my LinkedIn, I've made considerable effort to connect specifically to executives in the design departments or construction departments of certain hospital systems. So you'll see that the director of construction of Nemours, or the director of construction of John Hopkins, and those are the people that have started to collect in there. Once in a while, on and off, like technology people or innovation people or futurists, because I'm very interested in those areas, or in charity, but I have made considerable effort to follow and connect specifically with those who would give me work. And that has made a huge difference as well, I feel, in where we are.
Yeah, very, very good advice. So you're building this firm. You're super busy, crazy busy.
Yes.
I have two questions. And then I also want to talk about Chicago, because you're talking, you mentioned before something about Chicago. But let's talk a little bit about, for one, how do you keep the stress down now? Because now you're all in on this. You are full blast, and you're obviously conscious about your health. So how do you stay healthy? And you're also a great mom. You're very focused. I follow you on Twitter and Instagram, and I see that you're with your daughter and you're an active mom. How are you doing that? How are you, keeping your priorities straight and staying healthy?
Yes, I have to be very deliberate about it. And by deliberate, I mean literally, or at least for the most part, I get home, I take a shower, 2-3 p.m., and I have to sleep for an hour, for example. That's something that I do almost every day. There are the days that I cannot do it. But for the most part, I do that every day. Even if I wake up and start work at 7:30, I'm an early person. As a construction person, it's easy to get there. And I will start working at 7 or 7:30. But by 2 or 3, I'm sleeping at least half an hour. And then once I get my daughter, I stop all work. I may answer, I do function almost still as an owner rep. So I may answer a text or a call if I really had to in the times that I have my daughter. But for the most part, I do not. And when she sleeps, because she's a baby, she, 18 months, she'll fall asleep at around 7 or 7:30. At that point, I'll pick up whatever I didn't pick up while I was with her. So whether it's a text or an email, but generally, because I'm very proactive, I don't usually have to do anything in the hours that I'm with my daughter. So basically, I think it's about hyper-focus. You really have to be focused in the task at hand. And that sometimes does not work, but your family. And don't blend them, don't mix them up. I don't think that's beneficial at all. And I find that that hyper focus will also allow me to rest enough to then sort of start all over in that overdrive and over everything that I live in the next day. So, yeah. And I do sleep long hours. I mean, besides the trying to sleep in the middle of the day, I literally go to sleep at like 8 and wait. So I sleep about 10 or 11 hours a night. This is another thing. I think it's the beauty of starting a firm is being able to do that.
Yeah.
I don't think you start a firm to work 80-hour weeks. I don't think you should. I think if you put in the work, the hard work to get licensed, then go through all these hours with other people that you may or may not get along with, to which I did, by the way. I love Joby, who gave me my hours, but once you get past all that, you put in all that work, don't work 80-hour weeks. I mean, you should really be, it should be a time to start to enjoy all that hard work, right? At least that's how I see it. And as far as the stress, it's hard to explain, but the stress is different because it's my own and not imposed upon me, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So the stress levels are different, and they don't tie to the thing that ties most people to stress, which is sort of your income. Because at this point, you're running a firm, your income starts getting a little bit better than your job, right? So when you had a job, you made whatever it is. But when you're running a firm, now you can start billing as a firm. It starts to look very differently. So your stress levels change. But I really think that's the beauty of it. Imbalance is very important. As far as exercise, I tend to exercise, particularly yoga, but have not been so good these last few months, only because of really mostly my daughter. She still gets a lot of my attention, and I think it's more important that I do that still than say worry about whether I go to the gym for 2 hours a day. I'd rather give those 2 hours to my daughter.
Yeah. So very, very intentional about,
yes,
about
very
your routines. You've established some very specific routines.
Yes.
You've created this transition zone between work and home, where you come home, you take a shower, you take a nap, and then when you wake up, you're
my
mom.
Daughter gets, yes.
Yeah. So there's this very intentional transition between work and home.
Yes.
And the fact that you have control. So the stress is different stress. The fact that you can come home at 2 o'clock and take a shower and take a nap and then be mom is because you've started your own firm and you have your own structure and your own schedule.
Yes.
And so it's very, very intentional.
Yes.
You mentioned at the very beginning the campaign that you're running for Puerto Rico. You want to talk about that very briefly? And then I want to hear about your your future, what your future is for Ponte Health.
Okay, so the campaign, which you were so generous to help us with, I just felt the really strong need to carry it through because of the issues that are post-storm disasters for babies, especially or more significantly about feeding. When you have the post-disaster condition, you have ponding waters and lack of drinking waters and things like that that start to propagate disease. So because our mission is to help expand the healing community, of course, the post-disaster condition is sort of against that. It's working directly to our mission. Babies that breastfeed do get sick through lactation. And then mothers that don't get enough water will not be able to breastfeed. So it's just a lot of compounding problems, yep, if you will. So when the things with Puerto Rico are so bad, and I know, and again, I'll repeat this, it's in many places in the world. Yep. Think about Caracas, and I'll point that out. Caracas is a place where I grew up, and I love that city. And conditions there are horrendous. Like, there's not even a word to describe babies in Caracas today. I cannot even begin to tell you. But the political environment there doesn't allow me to help. Mm-hmm. So because I can't help, it doesn't mean that I don't think the issue is there. And it happens really across the board. So with Puerto Rico, it was really bad, but I had people there, and it's easier to get things there. And I wanted to sort of make a difference with the baby specifically. As you know, it required a lot of money to get a charter, which is what I originally intended to fly in. And it hasn't really gone that way. So we've sort of re-strategized into, okay, can we make a direct connection with a pediatric hospital? And we did. It's called San Jorge in San Juan. They're basically taking in all the small babies and children from vicinity and beyond, and they'll take it. But they did tell me the kids are coming in really sick and really dehydrated, and though people are donating formulas and foods and things, they don't have bottles to give them the formulas. They don't have enough Pedialyte for the dehydration. So with this campaign, we are trying to get a handle, at least at some level, of this need that they have specifically in the pediatric hospital. Plus, I'm trying to work out ways to get more remote. But the truth is, the island is sort of destroyed in a way that you can't really get around. Mm-hmm. So there's more to it than that. And, you know, if I had a plane myself, I would have already gotten there. But we're not there yet. Yeah. So I do the best that I can, and it evolved into what I call now disaster babies, because I feel the need to be like a first responder every time now, because I feel like the babies are not being thought of enough, if you will, yeah, but with all the health issues that get compounded into it, into them and their condition post-disaster. So Disaster Babies was born, and it's a mission. It's not an organizational structure or anything like that. It's just a mission by us to try to carry out progressively, basically, from this point forward.
Yeah. So the big mission of, you know, chartering an airplane and flying this in there, that was a big leap. Much like other leaps you've taken. So
everything I do seems to be a leap.
Right. And so you're going to, you know, feed babies in Puerto Rico, and you're going to do this as big as you can. And so you say, okay, I'm going to charter a plane. The plane costs $30,000. We're going to fill it with 1,600 pounds of food, and we're going to fly it over there, and we're going to save a bunch of babies.
Yes.
Okay. That didn't happen, but it at a smaller scale, it did happen. You know, you collected enough money to send some relief to Puerto Rico, and even bigger, it's become a long-term mission of yours now. It's become part of your organization to be a first responder in these disasters through Ponte Health. It's part of your overall mission to help and heal.
Yes.
So this becomes part of your mission, which goes back to your name, Ponte Health, can be as flexible as you want it to be. Now you have this seed of philanthropy that can grow as you grow, and ultimately can become the $30,000 plane, figuratively, and help babies whenever there's a disaster. you can respond because you'll have started this now, and as you grow, it will grow.
Yes.
And it'll become a really big thing. Is there any way that people who are listening can contribute to what you're doing?
Yes, particularly the disaster babies, there's a link. They can go to tinyurl.com/disasterbabiespr. That takes you directly to the GoFundMe campaign. But what's fun about that campaign is that my business partner /husband, who happens to be a great martial artist, has kindly donated an hour and a half of self-defense training, which, by the way, he is a Krav Maga instructor certified. Krav Maga, I don't know if you know, is a Israeli self-defense technique.
Oh, wow.
It was created by the Israeli self-defense forces, and he teaches it week in and week out. And I said, what if we teach in exchange for this $10 donation and above? So whatever anybody can give above $10, they will get access to this hour and a half training. And it just works well. So you want to learn a little bit of self-defense, all you have to do is donate $10 to our baby fund at tinyurl.com/disasterbabiespr, which is our first responded mission. For the babies that will hopefully we'll be able to respond every time something significant, as long as we can, of course, something significant happens around the planet. And and philanthropy really is not just inherent in me. I really have always felt the need to give back. It's just something that I do because my life has not been the easiest, generally speaking. But it is inherent in a strong part of our company. Every time somebody comes in that they say they want to speak, work with us or grow with us, I tell them all the same. They have to commit 10% of their time to giving back. And it has to be to help expand the healing community. And the firm itself, we're committing to giving back 10% of profits forever to giving back in the form of healing community environments and buildings. So hopefully one day this baby's mission will also be, maternity wards and, children's orphanages, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, following your last few years and being sort of an audience to what you've been doing, I have no doubt that that will happen in a very big way. And you'll be giving back and it'll be a major, major contribution to the world.
Oh, well, thank you. We try.
We'll have links to all of that on our show notes at entrearchitect.com/episode189. So they can just go to episode 189 and we'll have links to the campaign and everything else that you're talking about. Before we go, I want to know what your future plans are for Ponte Health. And then I want to ask you my final question that I ask everybody. So what's in the future for Ponte Health?
Well, I hope some more of what we do now, which is to sort of serve as an integral turnkey company. But the truth is, I don't necessarily omit the idea or goal that I've had to actually create a health system. And that gets very complicated if I start explaining it, but I do want to enter that space, but it'll be along the lines of our own real estate holdings and development. So you can consider Ponte Health a sort of developer. Also, I see your company as really deeply involved with research. Scientific and for buildings and in technology. So I've been pushing a lot toward the sort of innovation area. And it's even part of the reason we're at the Guidewell Innovation Space for our office. We're surrounded by technology people at the moment. And plus I see us around the world. I mean, that sounds crazy, but I see it. My daughter showed it to me.
I don't think anything sounds crazy with you anymore, because watching where you're going and how fast you're getting there, no doubt.
So that's sort of the whole thing. I see us doing many things, but primordially giving back.
Yeah, one step at a time, right?
Yes.
Just what's next, right? do that. What's next? Do that.
Yeah, one thing at a time.
Yeah. Yeah. So exciting. So before we wrap up, let me ask you this final question here. What is one thing that a small firm architect can do today to build a better business for tomorrow?
Okay. So instead of one, I'll give you two.
Okay.
Which I live by, and I think it will seriously change the way they see themselves. And A is to read a lot, and not architecture. Read business, read marketing, read strategy, read competitive advantage, read leadership, you know, sort of self-reflection. For example, one of a really great book, even though it's crazy because it's completely unrelated, that I read recently was Tools of Titans.
Yeah.
And I thought it was great. I mean, there were little things in there that were fantastic. Blue Ocean Strategy, the Fascinate book, Made the Stick, all these books are great reads that every architect, I feel, or at least the ones that are trying to run a firm, need to really get into. And then the second thing is to talk to a potential client. Like literally walk in the door and shake a hand and talk to them and listen a lot, because you'd be surprised where there's space for you to serve them. But unless you're walking in, doing a handshake and sitting down and listening, you're just never going to get there.
So good. So good. The advice is so good. The links to all those books as well will also be on the show notes at entrearchitect.com/episode189. PonteHealth.com is the website, PONTEHealth.com. So you can go check out what Tabitha is doing there. Is there anywhere else that you'd like to have people connect with you and follow what you're doing?
Well, just I'm Ponte Health across the board, and I'm the one that, you know, the Twitter, the Instagram, I'm the one so far doing it all, though I am aware that at some point I will need somebody else to do it. And on LinkedIn, I'm also Ponte Health, though I am Tabitha. And they can, the only personal thing I have is really I created a personal Twitter account again, but it's empty. It's not my 5,000 people account that I used to have. I think I don't have more than 10 or 20 people in there now. Really, those are the only places. And other than that, you know, I think it's easy to find me that way. And that's what I got.
Okay, that sounds good. Tabitha, thank you very much for sharing your story and for sharing all the tremendous amount of knowledge here. So much value in what you're talking about. So many lessons to be learned. Thank you for coming here on Entree Architect Podcast and sharing your story.
No, thank you so very much for having me. I mean, finally, and not the archived version, but the current version of me. It's great. Thank you so very much.
I'm gonna hold that one for ransom. The first one's gonna be ransom. When you become a multimillionaire, I'm gonna say, "Hey, you remember back?"
That's hilarious.
And we'll have,
I love it.
We'll have another episode when you break that $1 billion company mark, and we'll talk about how you got there from here. Thanks,
okay.
Thanks for joining us. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you so very much.
What a great and inspiring story Tabitha has. I can't wait to see where Tabitha goes from here. It's every time I see what she's doing, it inspires me to be a better me, to build a better firm, to build a better platform here at Entree Architect for you. If you were inspired or learned something from this episode, share it. Share with a friend. Pick a friend and share this episode with them. Share the link, entrearchitect.com/episode189. This is episode 189, and that is the link to share, entrearchitect.com/episode189. And don't forget to visit the website for the free course. Go download it. It's free. Profit for Small Firm Architects. It is a very valuable resource that we give away. It is certainly something that we could sell for probably $200 or $300, but we give it away. We want you to be introduced in what we're doing at Entree Architect, and that is a great way to introduce you to the Entree Architect platform and the things that we're doing at Entree Architect Academy. And it's very, very beneficial. If you only take that course and that's all you do, I'm happy for it. It will definitely teach you to be a more profitable architect. And in the end of the day, that's my goal. My goal is to help you succeed as a small firm architect. So go download that course right now. It's free, entrearchitect.com/free course. My name is Mark R. LePage, and I am an entrepreneur architect, and I encourage you to go build a better business so you can be a better architect. You can't be the best you can be if you're struggling to make money, struggling to be profitable, struggling to pay your bills. So go build a better business so you can be a better architect. Love, learn, and share what you know. Thanks for listening. Have a great week.